So then let me move to a formal introduction of today's speaker. I want to welcome you to the 430th meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. Both to our members and guests who are here today and to our public radio audience, reaching us through the stations of the Maine Public Radio Network. Today's meeting comes to you from Northport, Maine, and I'm George Look, president of the Forum. The Forum was founded in 1983 as a citizens' forum for study and discussion of the development, formulation, and implementation of U.S. foreign policies and factors influencing them. We are now in our 36th year of monthly meetings, featuring prominent speakers covering all aspects of U.S. foreign policy. Details about and audios of past forum talks, upcoming forum programs, and how to become a forum member are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. Today, we're very pleased to have with us Dr. Courtney Ratch, who will be speaking on Enemies of the People, the Shifting Front Lines of Journalism. Dr. Ratch is advocacy director at the Committee to Protect Journalists. She serves as chief spokesperson on global press freedom issues for the organization and oversees the committee's engagement with the United Nations, the Internet Governance Forum, and other multilateral institutions, as well as its campaigns on behalf of journalists killed and imprisoned for their work. As a veteran journalist, researcher, and free expression advocate, she frequently writes and speaks about the intersection of media, technology, and human rights. Prior to joining the Committee to Protect Journalists, Dr. Ratch worked for UNESCO, edited the flagship publication World Trends in Freedom of Expression and Media Development, and managed the Global Freedom of Expression campaign for Freedom House. She has worked as a journalist in the United States and the Middle East with Al Arabiya, The Daily Star, and The New York Times. Her book, Cyber Activism and Citizen Journalism in Europe, Digital Dissidents and Political Change, was published in 2016. Dr. Ratch has a PhD in International Relations from American University, and she speaks Arabic, French, and Spanish, and from my conversations with her, she also speaks fluent English. Courtney, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Just to clarify, with cyber activism and citizen journalism in Egypt, although I'm sure it is fascinating in Europe as well. Thank you so much for the invitation to come here and address the Midcoast Forum. It's amazing to see such a turnout in such a small, beautiful town. So thank you for the invitation. I am here today addressing you as an enemy of the people. That is what my president has labeled me and my fellow journalists. And at the Committee to Protect Journalists, actually most of us are journalists, and we consider ourselves journalists still, and most of us come from a traditional journalistic background. And in fact, yesterday and today, I've been on call with my colleagues reporting on the latest incursion in Turkey, in northern Turkey, and trying to understand what exactly happened yesterday when a civilian convoy was targeted and at least one journalist killed and several others injured. Because what we do is we're reporting every day on attacks against the press like a news service, covering those issues. And we want to make sure that journalists who are going in, whether they're freelancers or staff journalists, know the risks that they're facing and are prepared. This is not fake news. We're certainly not enemies of anyone. We're really out there because it's news of the utmost importance. And so much of what citizens and people know about what is important in their communities, the communities that we live in and are working in every day, is because of what journalists are covering, because what they're digging into and investigating, that they're going every day to the local courthouse or the state house and covering on the day-to-day that local beat. The people who have investigated and cajoled people into talking, who have dug through reams of documents and data and tried to figure out what is the story there. What is this raw data, these financial documents, what is this person trying to get across? And whether we're talking about the Panama Papers or the Paradise Papers or the Me Too movement or USA Gymnastics sexual abuse scandal or the latest on corruption and scandal and data breaches by you know, whatever financial firm of the week it is, all of those stories we know because a journalist dug into that. A journalist decided to report, decided to try to convince someone to talk, to give documents. So, you know, these journalists are on the front lines of holding those in power to account and in ensuring that citizens are able to enact their right to know and their right to be informed. So, you know, President Donald Trump has called the press the enemy of the people and pitting us against our fellow citizens, when in fact, we are in the field of journalism to serve them. That is what journalists do. But this clarion cry has reverberated around the world, and it's having global implications. Those in power have taken up this clarion cry, and they are pillorying journalists and denouncing the media as fake news on a regular basis. And this is as the public is increasingly struggling to find out what is true in this post-truth era. But I really believe that journalism is the light that disinfects the dark halls of power and helps hold those in power to account. And so when journalists and the media are branded as enemies of the people, when they're thrown in jail for publishing false news, when they're murdered with impunity, that light fades. And amid the obfuscation and the redirection by those in power, you know, who would rather not have a pesky reporter digging in and asking questions and trying to find out what's really going on, it's really the public and the citizenry who are suffering. And so I want to talk today about the weaponization of fake news and the dangers that are posed by framing journalists as enemies of the people, because it's not just rhetoric. I'm going to talk to you about some of the stories of the people on the front lines and how these startling statistics are really imbuing the real dangers that journalists face doing their job, and how the media is stepping up to defend press freedom, because it's actually never been more dangerous to be a journalist. We have record numbers of journalists killed every year, and for the past 3 years, record numbers of journalists imprisoned, with more than 250 every year for the past 3 years, record highs. So, you know, freedom of the press is a fundamental value that is really upholds the ability to enjoy so many other human rights. And of course, it is a fundamental pillar of democracy. And in non-democratic countries, it's only because of journalists and reporting by them that we know so many of the abuses and core issues that have some meaning to those, to the, you know, the public interest. Not, of course, to mention corruption and cronyism and all of that. When I worked in Dubai as a journalist for Al Arabiya, it was during the economic boom of 2008 and then through the economic crash of 2009. And they decided to pass a draft law to criminalize the reporting and publishing of news that undermined the economy. But in 2009, there were literally no other stories except the crisis, right? So I actually thought that I would have more difficulty writing about human rights abuses or, you know, abuses in the labor camps. But in fact, a year into my tenure there, I published an article about safety problems on Emirates Airlines. It turns out that the head of the airline is also the head of the civil regulatory authority for the airlines. Now, that is a recipe for disaster. How do you have oversight over your own agency? So I, you know, straightforward business story, I published this. I really didn't give much thought to it until my colleagues said, you might want to watch out because there's this new law. And I was fired the next day, and my visa was canceled. Me and my husband had to leave the country within 30 days, which was not quite long enough to file a wrongful termination suit. Very convenient. You know, so it was very complicated, and we paid a great price. And I knew by choosing to publish that story, even after the warnings, I felt if you can't at least publish a public safety story as a journalist, what else can you write about? And I'm lucky that I didn't have to pay a greater price that so many of my colleagues have. And that is when I transitioned into journalism and press freedom advocacy. And a lot of times people say that these things are in opposition, that you can't be an activist and a journalist. But I think that one of the things you're going to come away with from my talk today is that you have to be an activist for press freedom if you're going to be a journalist in this day and age. And in the decade that I've been working in the field of press freedom, I have never seen it so bad for journalists. I think press freedom and journalism is really facing an existential crisis. The battle over truth and the role of the media, you know, has always been fraught. Okay, this is not something new, right? Going back to 1794, a French law set up a revolutionary tribunal to punish enemies of the people, and it codified the spreading of false news as a political crime punishable by death. So this is certainly not a new trope. And while we're better off today, since the publication of fake news is no longer a capital offense, it is a criminal one in many countries. And so what we're seeing at the Committee to Protect Journalists, where we systematically track the imprisonment of journalists and why they're imprisoned, is the increasing adoption of fake news or false news laws. They're ostensibly aimed at stopping or staving the flow of disinformation, but in fact, they're often used to imprison journalists. And in the years since President Trump has made fake news his mantra, countries around the world have not only adopted false news laws, but they've increased the usage of those laws and the imprisonment of journalists under those laws. So we actually have seen a tripling of the number of journalists imprisoned under false news laws and three times as many countries using those fake news laws. And a study by the Poynter Institute found that at least 48 countries are considering or have adopted a legislation ostensibly aimed at dealing with misinformation that would outlaw or sanction misinformation. So this incendiary rhetoric destroys global norms, and it creates the conditions, permissive conditions for repression, and it inoculates the public against the power of truth and fact. And so according to an analysis that my colleague at CPJ did, looking at President Trump's Twitter feed between the time he declared his candidacy and the end of his second term, they found that there were more than 1,300 tweets denigrating, pillaring, or attacking the media or individual journalists. And this amounted to more than 11% of all of his public communication on Twitter. So it's pretty significant. And she did an analysis of the tropes that are being used, and it looks like there has been an escalation. So it really started from the introduction of this fake news concept, which again has been very interesting to leaders around the world. And then it moved to opposition party, and then to enemies of the people, and then to treason. And Trump uses his tweets to respond and react to critical coverage and investigative reporting. And he even said, he told Leslie Stahl before she did an interview with him, that this was part of his strategy to discredit and demean the press. So when they report negatively on him or report contradictory to whatever he wants to be done, no one will believe them. And I wonder if that's really working, because it does seem to be working for him and for countless other leaders around the world. So in Brazil, President Jair Bolsonaro has tarred the media as fake news, verbally attacked journalists on Twitter. His rants on Twitter really echo his American counterpart, and we're seeing the same thing with Rodrigo Duterte, who is the president of the Philippines and has also really led on some of the use of his Twitter feed to pillory the media. He's called the media spies. He's restricted access to his events. He has launched investigations and legal claims against journalists who have reported critically on his drug war, including Maria Ressa, the CEO of Rappler, and a dear friend who's facing nine charges now and has had to pay more in bail fines than the former dictator had to pay. We've seen this with Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister of Hungary, who's presided over the dismantling of the free press there, the real dismantling of independent press and other democratic structures in his country, and who said that President Trump represents permission from the highest position in the world. So for presidents of democratic countries to stand at a podium or at the helm of their Twitter feeds and call journalists enemies of the people, and the mainstream media denigrate them as enemies of the people, is dangerous. And it has real repercussions on actual people, on journalists, and of course, on our broader democracy. And coming as it does when freedom of the press is under assault worldwide, they are really deepening the damage that is done at home and abroad, and it's making the world less safe to do journalism. And they're attempting to immunize themselves from criticism and accountability. And many of the same actors who bandy around this term, fake news, are engaged in their own disinformation campaigns with bot-propelled armies and algorithmically inflected disinformation campaigns. And these disinformation armies have been deployed by countries around the world, so, you know, perhaps it's not surprising that those in power keep trying to deflect attention from what they're doing by condemning the truth tellers. And we're seeing that across the political spectrum, governments and those in power are weaponizing information. They are raising armies of trolls and bots. You can buy them now, and since money is speech, we're in a whole new arena here. And what happens is that this warps perceptions. It hounds critics into silence. The online harassment of journalists is unparalleled. It is one of the biggest threats that most journalists face and feel on a daily basis, especially women journalists or journalists of color. It fuels political polarization, and it eviscerates the middle. It eviscerates the moderate middle. And there's a project called the Computational Propaganda Project that found that at least 28 countries have weaponized disinformation campaigns, from Bahrain to the United States to Russia to Egypt. And this manipulation of the media, the political polarization, ends up weakening journalism. It weakens journalistic coverage and public discussion of key interests of commonality. It hollows out the center of the political spectrum. It makes it more difficult for moderate positions to be heard and debated. And therefore, it deprives the public of a critical public sphere. So at the same time that the news cycle is getting faster and wider content distribution, the 24/7 news cycle, social media, all of these factors are making it harder and harder for the public to decipher what information is valuable. And it blurs the line between fact and fiction. So journalists must compete in this ecosystem with one hand tied behind their back, because they have journalistic standards, because they're the economic models on which they have based the entire journalistic industry is being pulled out from underneath them. It's completely transformed. And so they're struggling to be heard through the morass of disinformation and just cluttered information. And meanwhile, you have media companies that are grappling with government pressure to do something about this, to fight back against misinformation and disinformation. And they're taking measures and looking inward on how can we combat fake news, how can we combat, on our own platforms. And so you've seen fact-checking initiatives spur, rise up, and Facebook and Google are sponsoring a bunch of different fact-checking initiatives. And so they're trying to curtail or remove this scourge of inaccurate information, while they're also trying to do the reporting. And as local news outlets are vanishing, and as entire beats go unreported. And so, while the threats posed by, real disinformation are real, it's also difficult for even the most well-intentioned governments to address the problem of fake news without also running rampant over the rights to freedom of expression, the rights to the free flow of information, and the rights of journalists. And so when governments have taken legislative action, or the language has been loosely crafted, a lot of them are not really understanding the technologies on which we are working, and the implementation has been sloppy. And so there are few mechanisms to ensure transparency, accountability, reliability, and in several cases, it has given authorities the permission to double down. It's an excuse to double down on the repression of journalists. And double down they have. So So Trump has escalated his incendiary rhetoric recently by accusing the New York Times of treason, a crime which is still punishable by death. And it was punishable by death 200 years ago in France. And Trump joked with President Putin about fake news media on the one-year anniversary of the murder of four journalists and a media worker at the Capital Gazette in Annapolis. So last year, when my colleagues at the Capital Gazette were murdered, that made the United States the fourth deadliest country in the world, on par with Mexico. And Trump and Putin were joking about the fake news. And experts have noted that branding someone as an enemy of the people could amount to a death sentence in some contexts. And I don't think most people believe that Trump really wishes death on those that he criticizes and those that he calls his enemies. But his rhetoric is a nod to extremists and authoritarians alike. And he has resurrected a trope that even leaders of the former Soviet Union, Nikita Khrushchev, said was specifically introduced for the purpose of physically annihilating such individuals who disagreed with the Supreme Leader, and who called, Nikita Khrushchev called for an end to the use of the term, yet it has been resurrected. And let me tell you, journalism is dangerous enough without being labeled an enemy of the people. It is really the only profession I can think of where people are routinely murdered for the work they do. So journalism is already very dangerous. We have been keeping systematic records of all of the journalists killed since 1992. The majority are not killed in crossfire. They are not killed on the battlefield. They are murdered in direct retaliation for their work as journalists. So reporters and journalists cannot just sit on the sidelines. They have to go to the front lines to tell their stories, whether it's the courthouse or the battlefield. And the front lines are dangerous, without a doubt. I mean, more than 201 journalists have lost their lives in crossfire or dangerous assignment reporting on the wars in Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan. But almost as many were murdered. Of the 1,344 journalists that we have confirmed were killed in the line of duty since 1992, two-thirds of them were murdered. And one of these was Lisantha Wickramatunga, who was a Sri Lankan journalist murdered in 2009. I've met his wife. And in his last column that he wrote in his local newspaper, he said, "No other profession calls on its practitioners to lay down their lives for their art, save the armed forces and, in Sri Lanka, journalism." And we have to add to that in Mexico, in Brazil, in India, in Russia, in the United States, and I mean, frankly, the list is too long at this point. The dangers that journalists face to report on uncomfortable facts and to bring the public news, whether it's corruption, human rights abuses, environmental degradation, or terrorism, are extreme. And sometimes it's because they dare to opine. So I'm sure you've all heard of Jamal Khashoggi, a Saudi journalist who left Saudi Arabia, he had an ambiguous past in Saudi Arabia, but he decided he wanted to use his platform to critique the new rulers there, to critique the human rights abuses, the narrative of reform that somehow so much of the media was portraying about Mohammed bin Salman, despite the fact that somehow in 2019 giving women the right to drive was an amazing accomplishment. He left his country to be able to more freely report and opine about what he saw going on. And this coincided with Saudi Arabia's PR offensive. And I will never forget the day when, sitting there, I got a text message from a colleague at the Washington Post and from my colleagues in the Middle East saying, like, "Have you heard from Jamal? Do you know what's happening? Are you guys reporting on this at the Committee to Protect Journalists?" And we did. We published an alert saying we're really concerned about, this guy who's missing. And over the next several days, bits of information began to trickle out. And it was fascinating to watch Turkey, the world's leading jailer of journalists, 3 years running, responsible for most of the information that we saw, and how strategic they were at letting that information drip out as we figured out what happened, and obviously revealing that the Saudi consulate must have been extensively bugged. So, do you know the title of Jamal's last column? It was called What the Arab World Needs Most is Free Expression. So his last column was published posthumously. And like many of his columns, it was translated into Arabic, which I think the Saudis really didn't like. And he wrote, after listing a list of recent cruelties, he wrote, "These actions no longer carry the consequence of a backlash from the international community. Instead, these actions may trigger condemnation followed by silence." And his condemnation of international inaction and the impunity of authoritarians in the region to crack down on journalists and the press should have been a rallying cry, right? It should have galvanized any government that values and respects press freedom and the rights of journalists and the fundamental role that journalism plays in sustaining democracy in a representative governmental system. And instead, we heard from President Trump that arms deals with Saudi Arabia and the economic relationship are more important than what happened to this journalist and seeking justice. Now, I am not under any illusions. I've lived in Washington on and off for a long time, worked with many administrations on these issues, and there's always a balancing that happens. But usually that takes place in private, not in the very public, you know, well, this journalist's life's only worth this much and our relationship with Saudi Arabia. That sent a very dangerous signal all around the world. And we've heard, you know, grumblings from the EU, grumblings from Congress, but really we've only seen any action taken against low-level officials. And we heard very tepid comments from the UN Secretary General, and there was an independent investigation by a UN expert that made recommendations that have gone nowhere. We've seen no action seeking to launch an independent investigation or any sort of accountability. And instead, what we have seen is that it's up to media organizations. They have stepped up. They have mobilized in response to this latest tragedy against the press, and it's really interesting to watch. The Washington Post, to its credit, mobilized and created a new press freedom partnership where it's donating ad space and digital takeovers and pages to highlighting the plight of journalists. And we've been able to shine the spotlight on cases of journalists who are under threat around the world, and, you know, hoping that by highlighting these journalists and the importance of an independent press, it's not too late. And shortly after Jamal's death in Davos, a bunch of the editors of the world's leading newspapers met for dinner around a table and were saying, you know, what can we do? Like, this really is emblematic of the existential threat that we are facing. And just a couple months after Jamal's assassination, they met around this table and they said, okay, we are going to do what we as journalists can do best and shine our spotlight on the cases of journalists who are under threat before it's too late. So whether this is, you know, the Reuters journalists who, you know, were put in prison in Myanmar for reporting on genocide, what the UN called a casebook text of genocide, and then they were put in jail for it by a former Nobel Peace Prize winner. You know, we saw Reuters really mobilize to cover those issues. You know, I think news organizations are realizing, again, they cannot sit on the sidelines because it is their reporters, it is their staff that are under threat. And so they need to recalibrate the mass power differentials between, you know, the journalists on the ground and those in power. So how can they employ their collective muscle to do that? And so they gave birth to the idea of the One Free Press Coalition. So every month we identify for them 10 cases of journalists who are under urgent threat. And every news organization that's part of this coalition agrees to publish in their pages the list of these 10 journalists and share on social media. And we hope that what this spotlight will do is to help protect them and pressure their governments to respond. And we have actually seen some success. So two Nicaraguan journalists, I don't know if you've been following what's happening in Nicaragua, but that is definitely an important news story. And these two journalists, Lucia Pineda and Miguel Mora, were imprisoned, and we put them on the list in April and in May, and shortly after, they were released during the summer. We're actually giving them our International Press Freedom Award this summer. In April, we included an Indian journalist named Rana Ayub, who was the victim of a virulent online harassment campaign that included the use of a deep fake pornographic video that circulated around. We actually had to help get her out of the country for a few months to let things settle down. We put her on the list because she's been under so much threat, and it was fascinating because it helped spur a conversation about the role of press and an independent free press in democracy right ahead of the Indian elections, the world's most populous democracy. And they started talking about whether the, you know, what about the threats that journalists face and about the question of whether democracy is possible without press freedom. And this is really important. She told me afterwards that having that international media attention on her case provided an opportunity for local journalists to spur a conversation and cover issues that otherwise they really couldn't have done without that international impetus and kind of coverage. And we hear that a lot, including, you know, Egyptian journalists, for example, who need that cover of the international community before they can then go and cover the same issues. And the brutal murder of Jamal and the continuing impunity for those who ordered and carried out his murder has sent a chilling signal to the journalistic community, and he is at the top of our list. He's on the list every month, and he will be until there is justice. And there are other journalists, like Maltese journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia, who was covering corruption in Malta, an EU member country, including the misuse of EU funds, and she was murdered. Miroslava Breach in Mexico also has paid with her life. There are too many to put on the list every month. And one can only assume that those who murdered them hope to send a signal to other reporters that those topics are off limit. But instead of stoking fear and creating self-censorship, it has galvanized the media. It has galvanized the journalistic community to double down on reporting, to double down on investigations, and to use their craft to report and combat impunity. So the mobilization of the journalism community is a really important development in the global struggle for press freedom. And at the Committee to Protect Journalists, we use long-form reporting on investigations into the murder of journalists to help spur justice. So for example, we went to Ukraine and did an investigation into the murder of investigative journalist Pavel Sheremet. And we found, we did an investigation into the investigation of his murder, and we found all these holes and uninvestigated leads and people who should have been talked to who weren't. We've done this in Mexico, in Pakistan, in India, and we have featured their last works in a book called The Last Column to remind people what is lost when these journalists are silenced. And we've seen this proliferate around the world. So there's a group called Forbidden Stories, which is taking a network of journalists and news outlets who are devoted to continuing the investigations of journalists who were murdered in order to make sure that that signal that, you know, is not sent, that they will not be silenced. So the Daphne Project for Daphne Caruana Galizia brought together 45 journalists from 15 different countries and 18 outlets who collaborated for 3 months to continue her investigations and inform the public about corruption and money laundering in Malta. And they drew on the evidence that this 53-year-old reporter had built over her 30 years of reporting. They did another one in late 2018 called Deadly Border, where they initiated an investigation into the kidnapping and murder of Ecuadorian journalist Javier Ortega and photographer Paul Rivas and their driver, Efrain Segarra. And they worked in partnership with 19 Ecuadorian and Colombian outlets in order to delve into the issues that they were covering on the Ecuadorian-Colombia border and keep their stories alive. Now, these journalists are not enemies of the people. Javier was investigating a secret communication channel between Ecuadorian police and the drug cartels. Daphne was reporting on embezzlement of EU funds. Pavel was reporting on the unchecked power of militias. And Jamal was reporting on the fundamental need for human rights. These were not fake news stories. These were real news about real problems facing their communities, affecting the public and their fellow citizens. According to research by my organization, the Committee to Protect Journalists, government officials or political parties were responsible for more than half of all of the murders of journalists since we began keeping records. So yes, we should be worried when those in power start using incendiary terms like enemies of the people and treason, while undermining the trust and accountability with this constant fake news refrain, because we know it has real implications. And we must push back, we must fight. We must fight back against the weaponization of disinformation by doubling down on journalism. And we must all stand together to protect journalists who are on the front lines. And I invite you to do the same, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Well, thank you very, very much. Not a particularly uplifting a message, but I think your call for citizens to actually engage is, in my opinion, is the right one. While we're collecting some questions, I always take the opportunity to ask the first question myself. And you've talked about the increased efforts to publicize these atrocities against journalists. Is there really any evidence that this is getting through to the general public, that you're seeing an upswelling of public, not just support, but actions, which are often required if you're going to make some changes? You've got to get the public energized in order to do it. Is that happening in this country or elsewhere?
I think that there's definitely a varied response depending, obviously, on the media ecology of whatever, you know, country or location we're talking about. So in Slovakia, there was a journalist and his fiance who were murdered. And there was a public upswell there. And they did put enough pressure on people that there were politicians who resigned. And there has been more justice in that case as compared to, say, Malta, where you have a very polarized, divided public and very few independent news outlets, much less investigative outlets. And the one that has really risen is called the Shift News to take over from Daphne, has been under extreme threat and faced a lot of challenges. So I think it really varies. In this country, you know, I think there was a lot of agony after the murder of Jamal, and most people seem to remember that. What is shocking is how few people seem to really remember that there was this mass shooting in Annapolis. But I think there is increased awareness about the threats that journalists face. I know that when I'm out talking to people, and I talk to a lot of students, and I'll ask them who the leading jailer of journalists is, and people now know that's Turkey, because that's become part of the description of what people understand. But it's hard to translate that into action. It is very challenging, for example, to get this rebalancing of the relationship with Saudi Arabia and this attempt to hold them accountable for the murder. But we're seeing efforts in Congress, and Congress theoretically represents the will of the people. So it's challenging. It is hard. You hear that there are more subscriptions, for example, to the New York Times or the Washington Post, but my understanding is that hasn't necessarily translated into local subscriptions for local news. So that is something that we're constantly trying to do, is to help people care and know and take action. But ultimately it's up to governments to launch investigations into the murders of journalists. It's up to governments to stop imprisoning them. And when they're behind that, it's really hard to get action. So I don't know, there's a lot of distrust as well of the media these days.
So you've led right into one of the questions, and that is, the murderers of journalists ever prosecuted?
In 9 out of 10 cases, the killers of journalists go free. So there is near complete impunity for the murder of journalists. Even when there is some level of justice, it's often only the people who are actually pulling the trigger or setting the car bomb who are investigated or brought to justice. It's so very rarely the mastermind. And so, of course, that sends a signal that you can murder journalists with impunity. And we have been tracking impunity and the status of investigation into each and every murder since for the past a little bit longer than a decade. And that stubborn 9 out of 10 cases has been the case since then. And we really haven't been able to move it much. And we're trying. But yeah, they get off free.
You've mentioned the social media. Really, seems to be only in passing. You've talked about President Trump's Twitter feeds, et cetera. Could you talk a little bit more about the pluses and minuses of the social media and distributing news and information on it?
One of the big challenges, you know, that I mentioned is that as journalists are trying to, you know, just stay safe and do their jobs without, you know, facing real security repercussions, they're also dealing with the complete economic realignment of the industry, the real decimation of the advertising industry. When you have two platforms, Facebook and Google, accruing 90% of digital ad revenue, and also becoming really central to the publication of news. Journalists, the media outlets are constrained by the platform design about what those platforms have decided to prioritize in their algorithmic design. And there really aren't a lot of choices, especially in countries where you don't have a free or independent press. So it was interesting because Facebook, for example, when it started to, it decided to recalibrate how it prioritizes organizational news, so for example, professional journalism, versus news that comes from your friends and family, and it tested it out in 9 countries, several of which were in Southeast Asia, and those news outlets in Southeast Asia and those 9 test cases saw huge repercussions on their ability to do digital advertising to reach their users. In the Philippines, where Maria Ressa is based, it is the largest user of Facebook. 97% of the population use Facebook. So you have to be on those platforms in order to reach the audience because that's where they are. But most people can't really name what the source of the news that they see on their social media feed is. So I think a Pew Research study did a study in the US that looked at the increasing number of people who get their news on social media, but the decreasing number of people who can name the actual journalistic source. You know, so saying I saw this on Facebook or I saw this on Twitter is different than saying, you know, I saw this in X, Y, and Z, you know, fake news outlet versus a respected journalistic outlet. So, you know, there are a lot of different threads of how the technology platforms that we're using for news have an impact. Furthermore, you have things, for example, when Facebook said they reported that there was this big movement towards video and that they were going to prioritize video and people were increasingly getting their information for video. So you saw tons of newsrooms reorient around video, hire videographers, get video editors, et cetera. Well, then Facebook revealed, oh, just kidding, that actually wasn't very accurate. And now newsrooms are kind of left to figure out, okay, well, what are we doing with video? So, you know, I think a lot of news organizations are interested in experimenting. They want to engage with their audience. They want to meet them where they are. But they're also having to play according to rules that they don't set, and trying to uphold journalistic values that might not really be privileged on these platforms. Because a lot of the platforms, if it's encouraging engagement, it's trying to keep you, you know, get you to share something, get you to like something, it favors, as I was talking about, you know, extremism. It can favor, you know, the divides and kind of carves out the middle. You know, how many of you guys share like very middle of the road articles? You know, it's usually those more incendiary. And so a lot of the challenges that journalism are facing come because of the technological design of the platforms, the algorithmic choices and the values that are built into those algorithms, and their attempts to maintain, you know, the integrity of the journalistic practice as opposed to any other sort of information or communication exchange.
Someone wanted to clarify whether all categories of journalists are equally at risk. Are photographers and video journalists at risk just as reporters?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And we do, on our website, which is cpj.org, you can actually go through our database and explore how journalists, whether they're local or foreign. So the vast majority of journalists who are killed are local journalists. And of course, nearly all journalists who are imprisoned are local journalists. Sometimes there are foreign journalists who are imprisoned, but it's almost always those local journalists because they're the ones reporting on their communities and pissing off that person in power, right? We know that freelancers and staff journalists face different levels of risk. And the murder of James Foley and Stephen Sotloff in 2014 by ISIS was a real wake-up call to the media industry to say, you know what, we have a responsibility to the freelancers that we hire just as we do to the staff, and created this thing called a Culture of Safety Alliance to really inculcate a culture of safety. We know that most of the journalists killed and imprisoned are male journalists. Versus female journalists or non-binary journalists. And, you know, there's a lot of questions about why that is. And just over the past year, actually, we had a big focus on photojournalists and the safety of photojournalists because unlike, say, a print journalist or web journalist, you have to be present. If you're a broadcast journalist or a photojournalist, you have to be there to take the photo or to take the video, whereas other types of reporting can be done, you know, remotely. And so they face different types of risks. We hear a lot, you know, when they're carrying a camera, that can turn them into a target, whether we're talking about in a war zone or covering a protest. So there are definitely different types of risks, but ultimately, the types of things that journalists need to do to keep themselves safe are similar. So all journalists should be doing a risk assessment. And one of the things we did when we surveyed photojournalists to understand what type of threats they face and how they're prepared. We found out a lot of them aren't doing risk assessments, and so we're helping to build tools and work with partners to encourage photojournalists to do that. And increasingly, you know, the types of threats that journalists face have to include the digital element, the online harassment, surveillance. If you're a journalist reporting on the border with Mexico or reporting on the migrant caravan, you should assume that you're going to be surveilled, that you might be in a government database, that you may get stopped and pulled over at a border for secondary screening, and your devices might get searched. So we try to really, you know, report on the different types of threats different types of journalists face so that they can be prepared.
Thank you. Then here's a question really about the history of all this. Is the post-truth era directly attributable to Trump, or were there elements already present in the U.S. before he ran for and was elected president?
I think that this is part of a broader process, and it's interesting because a lot of the tactics that were used by the Trump campaign and Cambridge Analytica were pioneered in the Philippines, for example. So Maria Ressa and Rappler actually did an investigative series in 2016 before the election, looking at some of the information manipulation, the troll armies, the manipulation of messaging, et cetera, and found that those were tactics that were being tried out in the Philippines, and Cambridge Analytica was part of that. Facebook has embedded its experts with political campaigns around the world, including with Duterte in the Philippines and other countries around the world, in Mexico, I believe. So it is not attributable to President Trump. I think what is attributable there is the elevation of fake news as an ideology, as a trope, that has resonated around the world. And because it is the president of the free world, you know, the president of one of the world's leading democracies, the, you know, so-called beacon on a hill, that he is talking about fake news. And not only, obviously, you know, news that is inaccurate or ends up having mistakes, but, you know, real facts and truth as being fake news, and to denigrate them, I think that's what's new. And what's interesting is, you know, of course, journalists get things wrong, but something that makes it journalism is that they then correct it and report it and put it out there. You know, and we've seen that resonate around the world, this post-truth. I mean, China is loving it. You know, there was Xinhua News Agency put out a tweet that said something to the effect of, you know, President Trump, we're glad you finally know what we've known for ages. Now, China has been on the top of the list of countries that imprison journalists, you know, as long as we've been making that list. So this post-truth era, I don't think was created by Trump, but it was certainly facilitated and expanded and legitimized by the rhetoric that he has used.
There's a large number of questions with a similar theme here, and I'm not going to read them all, but I think the one that kind of covers it in the most general terms is, how can the public identify truth in journalism? How do we understand what are the facts? Where do we go to find out the truth as opposed to the false news?
Well, I mean, I think that is one of the challenges, right, about getting news via an app or on a social media platform is you have to be more literate. You have to understand, like, what is a byline? Do you recognize that byline? What is the actual news source? And we're seeing news organizations try to do more to flag for users, you know, whether something is opinion or whether something is reported. I think everyone should realize, you know, journalism is called the first draft of history. It is not the definitive draft of history, if there is one. You know, we were reporting yesterday, as I mentioned, on this attack in northern Syria on the convoy, and we spent like 4 or 5 hours reporting because we didn't want to get things wrong. So, you know, it is difficult to say that there is a truth, right? There are different truths to different people, but I think there are such things as facts, right? It is a fact that there was an incursion in northern Syria yesterday. It's a fact that it was carried out by Turkey. It is a fact that somebody died or not. Now, how you put those facts into a framework and explain them is gonna differ depending on what sort of news outlet you work for. When I worked for Al Arabiya, so it's a Saudi-owned, Dubai-based, you know, Emirates-based news organization, we would Arabize the news. We would take news articles from the wires that were written for, you know, a French, if it was Agence France-Presse, or Reuters, written for, you know, British or global audience or American Associated Press, and we would Arabize it so that the terms would resonate with the people reading it. Now, we didn't change the facts, but we might, you know, reframe the focus or reframe some of the terminology. And so, you know, that was still journalism. There's no such thing as like one correct journalistic way to do things. So I think, you know, when you're trying to be a literate news consumer, you want to understand, and this is what I'm teaching the students in my international communications course at American University this semester, is to understand where is that journalist or that news outlet coming from? Where are they based? You know, how is this language, you know, are we talking about floods of immigrants or a trickle of immigrants? You know, those are both potentially accurate ways. We were just reading over breakfast the other day about, you know, a local Maine newspaper reporting on immigration into Portland, and you can portray that in different ways. So you want to try to separate out, okay, well, what were the facts and how are those facts being portrayed? So it is a fact there were, I guess, 300 immigrants that came to Portland. Is that a stream? Is that a trickle? Like, that's kind of up to you, right? So, you know, it's about being incisive and thinking about what you're reading.
Then there's even a larger number of questions related to the question of how bias in the media contributes to all this problem. Let me read one of them, which I think, again, kind of represents the broadest question related to this. Unfortunately, the use of the term fake news has been confused with biased news, whether it's Fox News or NBC or CNN. It is biased and contributes to the problem. Is your organization helping to discuss helping the public differentiate and navigate these biased elements of the media?
So I think that media information literacy is really important, and media bias is certainly something that has been an issue around for many, many years. And, you know, there are, I mean, back to, right, Noam Chomsky and manufacturing consent, and, you know, thinking about what causes media bias. Is it corporate ownership? Is it political ideology? And what that looks like in different contexts. I mean, Lebanon, for example, every news organization is affiliated with a different religious political party. In our country, you know, we have a variety of different news outlets, and, you know, at the fundamental basis of press freedom is you know, freedom, independence, and pluralism. So you want pluralism. In terms of what we're doing at the Committee to Protect Journalists, we're focused on press freedom and protecting press freedom and ensuring that journalists do not face reprisal for their reporting. It does not matter if you're a biased journalist, you shouldn't be killed. You should not be imprisoned because you had a biased story. We just don't believe it. Are there some journalists doing bad journalism? Absolutely. You do not deserve to be physically assaulted, to be have your freedom taken away from you, or to, you know, to lose your life. And that's where we focus on. There are many important organizations working on bias, but we're really focused on protecting the right of the people who are reporting.
So how about people who only rely on one source of news? What would be your recommendation in terms of
I would recommend relying on more than one source of news. I think it can be really instructive to read about something, whatever your area of interest is, and read about it in two different types of news sources. So, on the first day of class a few weeks ago, went around the room and said, okay, well, where do you get your news? What are your news sources? And then we talked about some alternative news sources, not alternative facts, alternative news sources. If you're reading, the general mainstream media, why not try, Mother Jones or, BuzzFeed or Mada Musser, which is this amazing independent news outlet in Egypt. There are so many opportunities to gain access to a pluralism of views. You've got new initiatives like Medium, which is this kind of, thoughtful blogging platform. So definitely get journalism from more than one way. And think about how to get reporting and journalism from non-algorithmically biased sources. So if you're only using an app, all of your preferences, your reading, is sending a signal to that algorithm that this is what you like and this is what you're going to want more of. So going back to these assumptions that the algorithms are making, it's almost always that you should get more of what you like. So try to get some news that you might not like, right? Go directly to a news organization, for example. Subscribe to your news outlets. Think about, buying a physical paper, going, again, directly to a news outlet. And, everything now, we talk about print, everything is online, whether it's print or video. So, be a curious news consumer.
Then there's a number of questions on the other side of the aisle here. Both the use of deepfake videos and the use of mimes. One in particular is a deepfake video that seemed to show President Trump killing journalists was shown at a fundraiser yesterday. Is this something that, balances things or does it make it worse?
I think deepfakes are, things are challenging enough and it's only going to get more challenging, right? It is hard enough. So one of the things, again, that we do, we report on attacks on the press. So in Syria, there have been a lot of journalists who have been killed and we have relied a lot on citizen journalism to investigate what exactly happened to that killing. We try to cross-reference different videos. There are lots, there are companies now, Bellingcat, Amnesty, we're all trying to understand what is reality. It is becoming even harder now and with deep fakes. So I don't think the answer is, this side deep faked the other side, so let's deep fake them. No. But it is very difficult for non-specialists and even for specialists to tell the difference between a deep fake video. I'm sure many of you saw the Nancy Pelosi one, this one that I talked about, Rana Ayoub, pornographic video. These are only going to become more common. So one thing that is being discussed in kind of the digital rights community is how could you make it more difficult to even manipulate a video without sending some sort of clear signal, at least in the metadata, so that those who are analyzing can tell. But we are at a new frontier where the technology is moving much more quickly than the ability of those, in the rights field or journalism to respond to, and way further and faster than policymakers are prepared to respond to.
Well, we could probably ask you questions the rest of the afternoon, but I believe our lunch would get cold. So I'd like to close it off there. And again, thank you very much for
thank you.
Informative, interesting talk. No, you can't leave yet.
Oh.
We want to give you, if I can get it out of here, the, I always say this and it's, I'm not sure, but the much coveted Mid-Coast Forum mug.
Thank you.
So for drinking your coffee or tea in the morning.
Maybe I'll get my husband to bring me coffee in bed. Thank you so much.
Thank you.